Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. If you're new here, hang out for a minute, get to know some of the other people. You don't have to, you can talk if you want. You can talk back to me and to my guest while you're listening. You can get mad. You can laugh. Do whatever you need to do. Just hang out and see if it works for you. I'm not everybody's cup of tea, but that's okay. It's a weird thing about getting older or getting more comfortable. I don't know, but I'm not really competing with anybody anymore. You know why? Because who gives a fuck? It takes too much energy to be jealous or compare yourself to other people. Because if you're doing okay, if you're just doing okay, you're probably winning. And I don't like to use the word winning. First, I want to say that Allison Janney, the Allison Janney, Oscar award-winning Allison Janney, one of the most amazing actresses and presences. Is that a word? Presences from the show. She's on the show Mom, but you've seen her in many movies. She's in the West Wing. She's been in a million things, but Allison Janney is here. All right. Hey, look, I've got some announcements, a couple of big breakthroughs, but mostly I'd like to tell the people of the UK and Ireland that I'm coming there in April. I'll be at the Lowry in Salford. April 4th, I'll be at the Royal Festival Hall back in London. April 6th, I'll be at the Birmingham Rep on April 8th. And on April 11th, I'll be back in Dublin at Vicar Street. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all the ticket info for the upcoming, I think, four or five more dates at the Dynasty Typewriter here in Los Angeles through February. Those are Sundays at 7 o'clock. So they're nicely positioned time-wise for those of you who need to get sitters or whatnot. Those are on February 10th, February 17th, February 24th, and March 17th here in Los Angeles. And then I got a couple of dates in Colorado coming up March 23rd at the Wheeler Opera House in Aspen, and March 24th in Boulder. I'll be doing a more extensive club tour, preparing the hour, reaching out to the people, doing multiple shows in multiple cities before I do a few theaters here and there, keeping it light, not trying to kill myself or win some goddamn prize. But those days will be forthcoming after I get done with shooting of the third season of Glow. So there's that. Something happened that does sort of imply change is possible on all levels, but certainly personal. And I'm not thrilled about it, but it happened, and it happened in a sort of a roundabout way in a theater. So what is the dramatic change? I've been doing a lot of comedy lately. I finally broke some ground on some new kind of, personally relevant bits, which is good, doing the work on that. I was at the Comedy Store last night, and for some reason Chevy Chase got on stage with no act at all, did nothing. It's sort of weird to see him, but I used to love him when I was a kid, but over time you start to realize, man, he seems to be a kind of cranky, nasty old fuck. And I saw him sitting in the back of the room. I didn't know why. I thought maybe he's just lonely, wanted to come watch some comedy and judge. But he got up there and he took questions for about 20 minutes, and it was up and down, but it was one of those things where it's like, why did that just happen? I guess he's Chevy Chase. He can get up there and do what he needs to do. But why did he want to do it? I don't know. It was very bizarre. And it happened. I saw it happen. I was there and I was wandering around the back of the room going, what's going on? What is going on? What is happening right now? 75-year-old Chevy Chase is up there asking people to ask him questions in the original room at the Comedy Store. But I think people were happy to see him. And, you know, that's what he did. There were some moments, but it was just a bizarre thing where you're like, why did that happen? That was not life-changing. If anything, it was a little slightly sad. But whatever. All right. So here's what happens. And this is really what I wanted to talk about. The change in my life is that I think I'm turning a corner on Steely Dan. I'm not dropping a bomb here. Maybe I am. I've been judgmental. And maybe this might give a portal of hope to those people that are upset about my point of view about, you know, Marvel movies. Maybe it's only a matter of time before, as I get older and softer, before I start to relent on my opinions about that. But so I was at a play, say the L right, play. That was really the high point, though. I don't go to theater much here in Los Angeles. But my friend, and I'm going to call him that if I can now, judge me, whatever, I don't care. My friend Tracy Letts has a play up here in Los Angeles at the Mark Taper Forum called Linda Vista. And Mr. Letts, my buddy Tracy, set me and my buddy Duncan Birmingham up with a couple of tickets last week. And we went, and I got to say, I don't know how many of you have seen any of Tracy's plays. I haven't seen enough of them. I saw August Osage County, which was genius. Won a fucking Pulitzer. I talked to him about it. But this Linda Vista play is fucking great. And I do not understand why. I've talked about this before. You know, go to the theater. It's right there. I drove down on a Wednesday night and I parked on the goddamn street down there. It was no hassle at all. And I went in and I sat. I didn't know what to expect from this play. But man, it was, for me, it was relatable. It was funny. It had a great pace and it wasn't tragic. It was sad in parts, but ultimately buoyed by the humanity of it and the comedy of it and the relatability of it. It's very modern. I don't want to give anything away, but there's some nudity in the play, but it's not gratuitous. It's kind of visceral and raw and necessary. And, it's a lot about relationships. It's about who we think we are as people and how we interact with others. And at the center of it is a cranky, smart, defensive, broken, self-involved man. But there's a lot of women around. There's a balance. There are relevant themes in it about relationships between men and women, between men and men, between ourselves and ourselves, between us and others, people from other countries. It's got it all, but it's all very confined, almost to three or four settings, an apartment in San Diego and a camera shop and a restaurant or two and a bedroom. But it's like, it just jams, the language of it, the pace of it, the comedy of it. And the main character, the guy who played the main guy, was just great. Everybody was great. And it's a Tracy Letts play, so it's got some punch, man. But where's the big revelation? Is that what you're asking? Outside of having an amazing night at the theater, what changed? I explained to you, it was the Steely Dan. How did it change? Well, the main character in the play, he likes Steely Dan. And in the play, in transitions, they played like two or three bits of Steely Dan songs. And I've been sort of weird and snobby about Steely Dan. I've always felt that it was too sterile, too jazzy, too clean, too, you know, orchestrated. The very tone of it I found condescending. But there was something about in between scenes, set changes. They played just a bit of Pretzel Logic. And there, it just like all of a sudden I realized like, wait, there's a blues song in there. I can hear it. And I got home and I put on Pretzel Logic, and I of course I know some of the songs on there, but I don't, I've always just sort of been like, oh, okay, yeah, of course I know that song. I know the chorus. It was pounded into my head, but never, I resented people that like Steely Dan because they really like them and it's almost like a fucking religion. But I listened to it all and I realized like that guitar is kind of a little dirty. That's not alienating. This is all right. It might be better than all right. It might be amazing. I'm not going to give it that. But point is, I turned a corner on Steely Dan. So Allison Janney, I was thrilled that Allison wanted to do the show because I'm a big fan. She seems like an amazing person and an interesting person and somebody I wanted to talk to. And it was I was excited to have the opportunity. She's currently in the show Mom. It's in its sixth season. It's on CBS on Thursday nights. She's also in the new movie Troop Zero, which has its world premiere at Sundance this Friday, February 1st. And this is me talking to the truly amazing Allison Janney.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
You know Phil Rosenthal.
I do know Phil Rosenthal.
So Phil Rosenthal invited me and my parents, who are in town from Ohio, to a goose dinner tonight. So today I text him and I go, what time's goose dinner?
Oh.
And he goes, 5 p.m. And I'm like, who is goose dinner at 5 p.m. So then I was like, I'm doing Mark Maron's podcast from 4 to 5. I can't be there at 5. And he said, well, see if you can do it earlier. And I was well, I'll see, but yeah. I think I'm just going to be a little late to goose dinner.
Where's goose dinner? Is that like in Palisades or something?
No, he lives over in the Wilshire area.
Yeah, I had him on years ago, and I think it went okay.
What happened? He said to say hi, so it must
No, no, we're fine. We're fine. But I watched a documentary he made about traveling to Russia to sell Everyone Loves Raymond to a global, anywhere he can.
Yeah.
And in the documentary, it was clear that his parents still lived in the house that he grew up in. And I had this moment where I'm like, why don't you get him a house? And he's like, they're fine. They're fine. And I just sort of like, yeah, I have $1 billion. Maybe you get your folks a house.
I think that he finally did, by the way.
Oh, good.
I also...
Goose is nice. It's very
Goose,
fatty.
I don't know. I'm afraid it's going to be a little gamey. I'm not a fan
It's not gamey. It's fatty. Things.
It is?
What, you've never had Goose?
I've never had Goose.
Really?
I've played Duck Goose.
Sure.
I've had been called Goose.
Been Goose?
I've been Goose. Yeah, all it, those things.
But not in an office situation?
No, not in a Me Too way.
You haven't been Me Too Goose?
No.
Good.
I've been listening to your I listen to it a lot.
You do?
Yeah, I do. And I was afraid to come on your podcast because I feel like I'm a better listener than I am a talker. So... If you could just talk to me for an hour. And I'm not...
Do you want to talk more about Goose?
No, I don't.
Oh.
I'm done with the goose. My goose is cooked.
I have one goose story where years ago, it was Christmas, and a drug dealer that knew everybody and was involved in everyone's life.
I can't believe a drug dealer is associated with a goose story.
Yeah, no, he had a Christmas party or a birthday party for a guy I knew that is now a farmer in Nebraska, alcoholic farmer in Nebraska. But they cooked a goose, but there was no plates. So it was just, really, it was just, there was no, it feels like there was no knife, but there was this cooked goose that people were just going at.
Did you just like pass it around?
Yeah,
and
just kind of rip off pieces. I don't think it was your traditional Christmas goose dinner.
No, that sounds not very, not traditional.
Yeah.
I used to have no utensil meals in college.
You did?
I went to Kenyon College in Ohio, and we used to, I don't know why we thought this was a fun thing to do. We'd go to the diner in Mount Vernon, Ohio, and have breakfast, and you just couldn't use utensils. So
we had to use your hands no matter what. It wasn't like a Moroccan themed.
No, it was a diner. You know, sunny side up eggs, sure. and you just had to eat everything.
You and your friends,
hands.
Like, was it a theater thing?
I don't know. It was a stupid thing. It was a really stupid thing. One of those things you do in college.
Did you smoke?
Oh yeah.
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 When did you give it up?
Who said I gave it up?
Oh, nice. Good for you.
Well, I'll tell
Hang
you what.
There.
No. No quitter.
Yeah.
No, I have. I've been back and forth with that, and I just I've quit so many times, and I'm reading for the fifth time Alan Carr's Easy Way to Stop Smoking.
Yeah, you got to read it again and again.
I'm reading it right now. Mm-hmm. I have a stop date again, but I did just have to play this role in this movie about Roger Ailes. I had to play Susan Estrich, Roger Ailes' lawyer. She's a feminist lawyer,
right.
Activist, rape survivor, incredibly smart woman. But she talks like this.
Yeah.
So I was, I was doing the whole movie like that. So though I can't stop smoking now. Gotta, you know.
Did she smoke?
Oh yeah, but you know, not on camera, obviously. But you could tell that she smoked. So I thought, I can't quit smoking now. I've got to keep smoking because I got to keep that voice going.
For real,
down
you want it to be authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you still have it. Good.
Well, so, I can go down there, but
yeah. Well, you know, if you keep smoking, you'll just have that voice.
I'm just gonna have Paul Malls fall out of my mouth.
Strangely mild for the fact that they're not filterless is my recollection.
I've
of
never
them.
Smoked a Pall Mall.
What was your cigarette?
What was?
Or is whatever, wherever you're at. What'd you start
can
with?
That? I started with, for whatever reason, Terryton's, because I'd rather bite than switch.
Would your folks smoke?
No, actually, that's not true. My first cigarette was my grandmother, who I blame. She glamorized it all because she would go to the beach with her straw hats and her yarn around her hats and her shaker of martinis and her Marlboro Reds.
Yes, that's what I started
so
with.
So I would steal, and she had them in her house in the little silver cups with the cigarettes everywhere back when it was you know? And I'd steal a couple of those and take them to the beach and we'd go under the boardwalk and smoke Marlboro Reds. It was kind of, it was like so... I mean, God, that habit was so romanticized and so mischaracterized, and everything it brings to you. They really did a great job of marketing that.
And
I
still love them. No matter what I know about them, my character on Glow smokes, and I got to smoke those horrible herbals. But you know what's nice about smoking? When you get cast to smoke, you know how to do it.
Yeah. Nothing worse than a smoker who doesn't know how to smoke. But I actually told people how to do it, because the trick is you never look at the cigarette. That's why you look like
Oh, yeah. It's just
smoker.
Part of your body.
You just don't look at
it. Yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so weird to have them back in my hand again.
God.
Marlboro Reds, though. I read just the other day that they were originally marketed to women before cowboys.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know when that happened, but I'm reading a book about the making of the Wild Bunch, and somehow it went on a tangent about Marlboro because of someone in the book. And originally it was marketed to women, and then they just shifted the complete other direction.
God, I wish I can't even see what the visual
what the
was
would be.
for women. It was probably, I don't know, but... God, they did.
Anyway. What about that Fox movie? How did it come out? What are you feeling?
Well, I didn't wait. I just finished. I think they wrapped today, actually.
Really?
But yeah. So it's not. It's just has to be edited, and everything has to come out. And I signed an NDA, so I can't talk about it. Except for to say that I did it.
And but what's his name? Roach directed it?
Jay Roach.
Jay Roach.
It. God, I love him. He's really, have you met him? Or
I met him on a plane once, and I have not, I think he wanted to be on the show. I should probably have him on the show, but I forgot until today.
You would
today.
Like him.
He seemed like a nice guy.
He's a really smart, thoughtful guy. As a director, as an actor, I got to work with John Lithgow, and we just were sitting together, and Jay would come over and say something, and John looked at me and said, everything he says I can use.
Really?
There's nothing he says that you can't use as an actor. It's really extraordinary, and he's really gracious and supportive and appreciative of what you do as an actor. And
it shot as a comedy?
No, it's
about it at all. But, I mean, he's sort of a comedy director, so I was just wondering.
Yeah, no, this is not
all right.
That.
Okay, fine. I
understand. Look at
I'm not
going to
try.
Naked Mind of Buddy Hackett. I'm just looking at your book.
His son gave that to me.
Really?
I stuck it up there. There's
I love
a few
it.
Books, you know.
I love the book. That's a book I would buy for its cover.
Exactly.
The Naked Mind of Buddy Hackett.
These are just some of the books.
And all your guitars.
Guitars. My, and then stashed over there, hidden, is the recovery stack. That's on the floor there.
Oh, I've got all my self-help books in the bottom of my shelf too, like tons of them. Every, my mother sent me one every week when I was in college.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
I've got recovery books too. I've got everything.
I'll be honest with you, when I've had, I don't know if I should tell you.
What?
Well, I had, like, you know, Brolin was coming on, Josh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I made sure I put my 12 and 12 up on this shelf so he would see it directly, so he would, you know, start maybe talking about it.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Because you're not supposed to talk about it, but no. I do openly. No. And, it's like, you know, fuck it. I mean, in my mind, it's like, you know, normalizing that thing is the best anyone can do.
I think so, too.
At this juncture, that tradition has to be rethunk.
I agree. I concur.
So now, Ohio, you went to Kenyon, but were you from there?
Well, I was born in Boston while my father was finishing at Harvard Business School. And
ooh,
then
that's fancy.
Fancy. And then they moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and then to Dayton, Ohio. And my father went into his grandfather's business, which was commercial real estate.
Oh, and he stayed in that?
And he stayed in that, even though in his heart, he's an artist. He's a musician.
What's he play?
He's a jazz pianist and he plays guitar.
Yeah.
He's just, my dad is 85 and he just, I bought him a recumbent trike for the holidays while he's out here. When I left, he was out on a bike trail somewhere and he'll come home and play guitar for hours.
Really?
Yeah, he just still sit and
pick
the
good?
Guitar. He's really good. His hands are, he's got some arthritis stuff, so the piano's a little harder for him, but he is, jazz piano was what he grew up doing. I
mean, and you grew up with that in the house?
Oh, every day. Yeah, I grew up with that kind of music every morning, every night he'd come home. And we used to joke that he learned to play the piano so he wouldn't have to talk to anybody because he yeah. loves to just be at the party and be the guy who's, you know, making the music, but
yeah,
he doesn't
yeah.
have to do any small chat, any, you know, chit-chat, anything.
Yeah.
But the guitar now, he just... Who was he? I set up my Sonos system for him on his phone, and he put on Jimmy Rainey.
That's
he's listening
guy?
To right now, a guitarist
okay.
that he's listening to.
What kind of jazz piano did he play? Old timey?
He loves like Fats Waller or Tatum, that kind of music. It was really great to have that growing up.
That's nice.
And yet I didn't. I mean, I learned to play the piano, but I didn't follow through on that. Instead, I wanted to become a figure skater, and then I went into acting, and then, you know, just it never, my musical talent didn't come out of my fingers.
But it was an encouraging environment to be creative.
Yes, and to music. For music is very much a big part of what I do when I act. I always have to find music that helps me feel a certain way, whatever I have to feel in a scene.
Yeah.
Music helps me get anywhere I need to go.
Huh.
Yeah.
So you can identify certain pieces of music that'll make you have certain feelings?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
And did your mom, was she a musician?
No, she was she was an actress. She went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York City.
She did.
And she did summer stock and was roommates with Rue McClanahan and Eileen Brennan. They were her really good friends.
Uh-huh.
And she did plays with Tallulah Bankhead and Tony LoBianco. But she was just like an apprentice at a summer stock when she did that.
Oh, and they were those older actors used mm-hmm. to do the circuit, right?
Yeah.
They'd come out and do like a family friendly or fun show for a few weeks.
Yeah. So she was in those and got reviews for her great legs. And one, I think that she saved that review, which was kind of fun to look
Tallulah
at.
Tallulah Bankhead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't, I have no point of reference for her. Like, I know a lot of older actresses. Do you?
No.
I know
really.
The name.
I know. Tallulah Bankhead. I can't think of one thing that she's in right now at all.
It's odd.
That makes me mad at myself. But Eileen Brennan, of course, is one of my heroes. You know, I mean, you have to know her.
I think so.
Last Picture Show.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, she's great.
The Sting.
Yeah.
You know, she's Private Bench. Saving
Private
Benjamin.
Yeah.
She's just genius.
Is she still around?
She is not. Mm. But I grew up getting to go see Eileen in a play. We'd go to Chicago because Eileen was in a play there, and we were kids, so my parents would take us to the...
And she's a friend of your mom still?
Yes. Yeah. Well, she was. They remained friends throughout her life. But so that's where I think I fell in love. I knew my mother had been an actress, and then I got to go see Eileen when I was a little girl, and it was so sort of glamorous and romantic to get to stay up late and, you know, to have Eileen come visit after her night on stage.
Yeah.
And I just idolized her, so I think
that did it.
That helped me, you know, make a decision to become a...
Dayton, Ohio.
It's a real nice way to spend the day in Dayton, Ohio.
Randy Newman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that song.
It's a great song. Mm-hmm. Did your dad do any major architectural masterpieces?
No, but my great-grandfather did. Frank Hillsmith, the Dayton Art Institute, they're a beautiful building, and he
built it?
Well, he didn't build it, but he helped make that come to fruition.
Yeah.
But no, mostly my dad's just commercial real estate, nothing artistic there.
Yeah.
I suppose in the wheeling and dealing of, you know, contract, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know about it either.
Yeah.
But it's a big business. They make strip malls and hotels and stuff.
He had a building that he was renting out to someone who had it was an ice skating rink. So that's where I got to go skating. So I got skating, free skating anytime I wanted. And I wanted to become a figure skater. And my mother would get up at, you know, 5 a.m. and take me to the rink to
come
work
on.
Yeah. I worked on my figures, the compulsory figures that figure skaters do, you know, they trace, you know, figure eights and loops and things. And
that came in useful to get yourself an Academy Award.
Exactly. It kind of did. I mean, you know why it did? Only because I knew the world of figure skating. I knew what it took for a mother to get up at that hour and get her daughter to the rink and how expensive things were. I felt like I had enough of a knowledge about it, a real firsthand, that I felt, yeah, I can play that role.
So when you were there next to the ice in the rink, you like it was familiar?
Yeah, absolutely.
How long did you do that for?
I only did it for maybe 3 or 4 years, and then I had this accident where I went through a play class window and
on skates. It seems like something that would take some work.
Much better story. I was going in for a triple axel and I swung too far and went
flew out of the ring and through the play class door of the rink.
No, it was at a party. I'll tell you the true story because I don't.
Oh really?
I don't tell everyone this true story.
Is there a falsehood out there?
There is.
Okay.
I just graduated from high school. Went to a very exclusive boarding school in the East, in Lakeville, Connecticut, called Hotchkiss.
Oh, really?
My father had
prep
gone
school?
There. Yeah, prep school. His father went there. My brothers went there. It was like one
legacy
of those things. And I was like one of the first group of women to go through there. I graduated and they were throwing a party for me at home at a friend's house. And there was a band, and there were parents and kids, and someone had just given me my first Quaalude.
Oh, good.
And which may have saved my life, because here's
slow
how
down
I figure
your heart.
That. You maybe.
Didn't, you
I don't
bleed
know.
Out?
Yeah, because I lost 3/4 of my blood. Like I did almost.
Oh,
it was
my
like, it
God.
It was, you know, and we were playing this game where the girls had balloons tied around their ankles, and you were in a couple, and you tried to pop the other couple's balloons.
Wow.
Okay. So
I wish I could say like, oh, of course.
That no game one's ever and, played that
yeah,
game.
Right.
And I was cheating. I had a strapless long dress on and I had it tied around my knee, but so no one could pop my balloon.
Right.
And so we were the last two couples and this guy was furiously trying to step on my dress and it ripped it and it started
came
to
off.
Fall off. And I was like in front of all these people and I picked up my dress and ran to go in through the porch, those sliding doors, and some of them were open and some
God.
Of them weren't. And I just crashed into it and the glass
God.
Like fell on, I fell onto my leg, which is where I lost.
You cut the big one?
And it cut, yeah. Oh yeah. My right leg, less artery tendons. It was crazy.
Oh and, God.
And I just, all I could do is I turned to the band, which right there, and they're all like, their jaws on the floor, and I'm like, and I'm thinking that I just cut my finger, and I'm just saying, keep playing, keep playing, keep playing. I'm like so embarrassed that I've stopped the party. Guy, please keep playing. And then I turned around and I looked at everyone in the party just staring at me, and it was like slow motion. And I thought, okay, this is a movie, and I'm going to scream, and I'm going to faint, and I'm going to die. And I remember thinking that, and so I screamed, and I remember falling, and I remember just seeing a lot of people's faces come in over the top of my head, like seeing people with drinks and cigarettes looking over to look at my face, and like it was the weirdest thing. And then the hospital people came, the ambulance.
There's blood all over?
There's blood all over. I lost 3/4 of my blood.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. It was a crazy accident that happened to me in my life. I was in the hospital for 7 weeks.
What?
I missed my first year of college. I just had to take a year off to
recover. And again, this helped you do the film Margaret.
Oh, yeah. See? Life into art. Yep, exactly. God, that talk about... Yeah, that was... fucking one scene.
That was insane.
Kenny Lonergan is one of my favorite writers on the planet. I laid in a pool of blood on Broadway and 74th Street for the whole day because I was covered in blood, and they were like, well, we're going to take a break. Do you want to? And I was like, what am I going to do? Go to Crafty? And like, I drip blood. I can't. I'm just going to stay here. Just give me a pillow.
With a Teamster.
And I lay on Broadway for the whole day.
With your fake leg, like over a few feet away?
Yeah, exactly.
That scene was so fucking leveling. Oh my
God. That movie, yeah, that scene was, and that's Kenny. Kenny directed me I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. Like, how do you, and he was like, be mad now. He just kept giving me different things to be.
For each piece?
Just giving me different directions because I think in his mind that experience must be very, like, you're obviously disorienting, but.
Dying. Yeah. Yeah.
It's more than that. I don't know. I just know that his direction helped me. Mad now and be.
But did you have with the same lines or was it with the. Were
same
you improvising?
Lines. Okay. No, same lines.
Okay. Just, so you just do different takes.
Yeah. I'm not a great improviser, except for maybe at the end of scenes, I'll come up with something to say in the silence. If they let the camera keep rolling, then I'm like, I'll come up with something.
A button.
Yeah. I love a good.
But that scene sort of like is the whole. Whole movie is built around you getting hit by a bus,
which is exactly what Kenny told me when he tried to get me to come from LA to do it. And he said, it's just this, it's a really pivotal scene, it's one scene, but you know, it will never get cut. You are in the movie, and that's what the whole movie is about. It focuses on that incident, so it's really important to me. Please come do it. And I said, I will do it for you.
Did you like the movie?
I love it. It's incredible.
It really is.
It's a masterpiece.
It really is. Like
the first post 9/11, you know, masterpiece, I think.
Yeah. And I talked to him about it, and I don't know which version I saw, because now I'm thinking like I just spent 2.5-3 hours and I might have watched
the
wrong
short version. Yeah. I don't know if I've seen the uncut version, actually.
But I thought everyone's so fucking good. And like the other woman who plays your friend. Now I'm forgetting her name. Elaine May's daughter.
Oh, you're talking about Jeannie Berlin.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And J. Smith Cameron.
Yeah.
Who's Kenny's wife. Who is.
She's great.
Brilliant.
She's great.
I love her.
But you didn't get to work with them because you're dead.
No, right.
Everybody's talking about you, but you're dead.
Yes.
You're long gone.
Yep.
Dead.
Yeah.
But a great movie. So you go through a plate glass window. Do you almost die?
Yeah.
Is that what happens?
Yeah.
3/4 of your blood.
3/4 of your blood.
Did you see, like...
I just know that in the ambulance, I was really irritated because they kept slapping my face.
Stay awake.
They didn't want me to slip into a coma, so they kept asking me all these stupid questions. But I didn't tell them I had a Quaalude.
Oh.
I didn't tell them.
See how deep shame runs?
I was so...
Your life could have hinged on it, but...
I didn't tell them
you
that.
You want to cop to it. Is this the first time you've really talked about that the Quaalude was involved? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it is.
Oh. Well, good. How does it feel? Do you feel like a burden has been lifted?
Not really. I mean, I don't know. I wish there were more. I would kind of like to try one without going through a plate glass window. But I don't think it's the reason I went through the plate glass window. I think it may have.
Kept you loose. Yeah. Could have been worse, maybe. It sounds like it was pretty bad, though.
It was pretty.
Maybe the Quaalude stopped you from cutting your neck open. But if you want to look at it that way, but it doesn't sound like he got off easy.
No, I kind of want to. Let's do our jaws thing here and compare scars. There's my scar here. See, it goes
Holy
like
shit.
This, and it went all the way down and cut across here and cut the tendons. And so my foot, I can't lift up my toes on that foot.
Oh, now?
Yeah, my foot's really fucked
up. So that's what got us there, is the end of your figure skating career.
The end of my figure skating career was that. And then, and then I went to Kenyon, and my freshman year at Kenyon College, that's when, you know, they had built this beautiful new thrust stage theater called the Bolton Theater.
Yeah.
And they had Paul Newman, who was a graduate of Kenyon, he was coming back to direct the first play in the new theater.
And you're a freshman?
I was a freshman, and I got in that production, and I got to be, there were just chorus girl parts for the women in that.
Yeah.
It was called CeCe Pyle and the Bunyan Derby. And,
why that play?
It was a new play that was that Michael Christopher, who had just won the Pulitzer Prize for Shadowbox, he wrote this play for Paul to direct, because Paul and Michael Christopher and Joanne Woodward, they're all friends. So they
in
asked
Westport,
Michael.
Hanging around?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And so they asked Michael to write this play, and he did, and it was the only production ever done at Kenyon. And I got cast in it, and started a friendship with Joanne and Paul.
As an 18, 19 year old?
Yeah. It was pretty great.
They took to you?
Yeah. Paul said, if you ever need a favor, you let me know. He said, it has to be very specific, so don't waste it. But if you have a favor, I want to help you out. And I never asked him for it, because I kept judging my favors. I was like, that's not a good enough one.
Really? Like, what were some of the options?
I don't know. I don't even know. Like, can you get me an acting career? It took me forever. You know, I was like, I didn't start working until I was 38. So I had a lot of years in New York where I was just doing, you know.
38?
Yeah. Yeah.
So wait, no. So you're dealing with Paul Newman in what year is that?
That's 78, 79, somewhere.
So
in there.
Wow. So like he was still like, it was sort of the new, older Paul Newman doing movies. Like around the time of The Verdict, maybe?
Yeah.
What a great movie.
Yeah. God.
But what kind of guy was that guy?
Oh, he was extraordinary. He was so, I love to watch the way he directed, because he loved actors.
Yeah.
He loved talking about acting.
He did.
Yeah. He really loved the whole process. He loved directing. He would sit and he would, you know, watch a scene going on, and then he wouldn't direct from out in the auditorium. He'd get up on the stage and put his arm around whoever he wanted to talk to and give a note to. And so it became this private relationship you'd have with Paul. And I kind of loved it as an actor, too, to know, like, I don't want to know what you're being told to do if I'm doing a scene with you, Mark.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool to not know what the director told you to do
and
see how it affects me. And I was impressed by how much he loved actors and acting.
I was just thinking of a moment I had. I'm new to really sort of.
You're great in GLOW.
Well, thank you very much.
You really are. I love the show. Chris Lowell's a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the show's amazing. And
well,
I think you're a really good actor.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I think if it's in my wheelhouse, I can do it. But here's what happened. To just talk to your story, which is better, but in terms of not knowing what the director is directing other actors to do, is I did a very short walk and talk scene with Robert De Niro in this new Joker movie.
Okay.
I'm going at it with De Niro, and it's cut, and then I see De Niro walk over to Todd.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, oh. And Todd comes up to me and goes, hey, man, like I didn't see him talking to De Niro. He goes, you're coming in a little hot. I'm like, okay, I'll take it down.
Yeah,
I'm a little jacked up.
I guess. But you'd hope that the director would, if the director wanted you to do that, he would do that. But I understand him going
that's the right route.
I've seen that before too. When I'm in a scene, and I see someone going to the director, and I'm like, my hackles go up. I'm like, what the. You know, Brad Whitford always says this funny thing. He says, when an actor gets a note, the first thing he thinks is, fuck you.
Yeah, right.
And then it's like, I suck.
Yeah.
And then the third thought is, how can I please you? How can I make you?
You guys worked together forever.
Yeah, well, I keep thinking it was 7 years. Maybe West Wing was 6 years. I can't even remember anymore.
It feels like it was on my entire life.
Oh, my God, yeah. I did. I mean, if I added up all my personal time in those 6 or 7 years, I I probably had an hour of free time. I mean, those hours were, I mean, do you have them on Glow? Do you have those hours? Crazy?
12, 13 hours. We're not, I mean, they usually make their days give or take an hour. Yeah. So like, you know, we're not going much over 12 hours, yeah. But we're, you know, some days, yeah. And you're dealing with a lot of people when you have the big cast thing. And everyone's got to be there, even if it's just to go, can I leave? You know, like, even if it's one line, you're still there.
Oh, when we were in the, we call it the awful office, because it was just, you would be in there for hours. And it, the trick was to place yourself in the scene where you'd have to be in the least amount of coverage. And that became the
game.
You
had that choice?
It was, well, you if you justified your care. No, I think that CJ would be standing here because she needs to be close to the door in case there's an emergency, like, whatever.
In case Allison needs to go home early.
Allison has a party she wants to go to. She has a plane she has to catch. Oh, Dulé was really good at that. Dulé Hill was really good at placing himself to get out of a scene.
Yeah,
oh,
just that you're like 5 feet away from all the other actors. There's no reason for like an over the other person shot.
No.
And no overs. I'm alone over here.
You don't tie me. I'm not tied into anyone. You're free to go or, you know, shoot around.
Oh, didn't the director ever come in and go like, why is everyone standing against the wall? But 38. So wait, so you now your relationship with Paul.
Yeah. And well, Joanne.
But you went through all 4 years at Kenyon.
I did.
And you stayed in theater, but you got, a liberal arts degree?
A theater history major.
But you were doing the acting, but that you couldn't major in it as an undergrad?
No.
Right.
No.
And then did you do graduate?
No. Well, I went to the Neighborhood Playhouse
in New York,
which is not just an acting, two-year acting program that Joanne Woodward had gone to, and she said, you should come to New York and go to the Neighborhood Playhouse. So I ended up going there, but not because I filled out. I don't know what my deal is, but I didn't fill out the application. My friend Allison filled out my application for the Playhouse and sent it in, and so I got a letter saying I was accepted, and I didn't apply. So things like that have happened in my life when people do things for me because they know that I'm a procrastinator and I'm
lazy.
Was
it procrastinating, or were you just
probably
sort of
a little
like
fear? I was probably afraid to go to New York and try to be an actor
from Ohio.
I didn't think I would. I just didn't think I didn't know what I was going to do.
Did you? Were you keeping in touch with them throughout college? This is pre-email, with the Newmans.
No, after we, you know, that play was a pretty big thing for all of us, and we spent a lot of time with them.
What did you learn from them during that, aside from the, you know, being an intimate director?
He's good. I played pool with him. I got to drive his Datsun 280Z.
So you learned how to drive a stick with Paul Newman?
No, actually, that was how I got, I auditioned for the play, and my grandmother had just given me a Scirocco.
Oh, yeah, the Volkswagen Scirocco.
Scirocco.
Yeah,
I had a
nice
navy
one.
Blue Scirocco stick shift.
Were there stripes?
No.
Okay.
Just navy blue with a tan interior.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And I talked about my drive from Dayton, Ohio to Kenyon College and how I could cut off this amount of time if I drove over the speed limit on the stretch and whatever. And I thought I was appealing to, I knew he was a race car driver, and I thought this would.
Your Scirocco stories would really charm
him. I don't know if that's what it was or if I just had the baby fat of a, you know, 1930s, 20s flat. I don't even remember what the.
But part of the audition was driving?
No, Paul just had to tell a story. They just said, get up on stage and tell a story.
You were appealing to his, you know.
I was appealing to his race car driving interests.
And so. It worked?
Well, it did. I got
you
cast. I don't know if that was it or if it was my good looks or, you know.
Maybe you just did a good job acting. Maybe you had that thing.
Maybe I did.
But what was his like approach to like talking about actors? Because like he's sort of a method dude, right?
I don't know if he's methody, but
I thought he was the Strasberg guy. No, what do I know?
I don't know which one.
Yeah,
he was. I mean, group. Joanne was definitely part of the group.
Yeah.
Theater, but I don't know about Paul so
right.
much. I just know that he liked talking about acting and choices, and I think
choices.
He was more into the cerebral part of it. Joanne came to it from the Playhouse.
So what is that? So you graduate college and you go to New York, you tell your parents, I'm going to New York, I'm going to be at the Playhouse, after your friend Allison gets you in?
I know, she gets me in, and I go, and they're like, okay, sure, yeah.
What is that thing? I remember seeing it. What was that Playhouse?
neighborhood playhouse was it was on 54th Street, yeah. 2nd and 3rd, somewhere there, a big red door,
right?
Like a town, four-story building, and they taught Latter Virginia, taught elocution, and there was breath. There was a little of that breath work.
So it was a school,
and it was a school, yeah, a two-year program. Yeah. They had 100 students in the first year, and then 24, you know, in the second year,
right? Everyone gets so really you get there's that big
there's
a cut.
That big a cut, yeah.
Holy shit!
And you learned about emotional preparation, and you learned about. I mean, there's some things that just are terrible because you learn to sort of disrespect the written words.
Oh, right.
Just any script, you sort of, they tell you to throw out, don't worry about the script. It's all about the emotion.
Really? Do you think the opposite is true now?
Yeah, it's learning to do, right. To work with the emotion. It's a good process to go through to not think of the
script. So read
the
it and think what's
well,
feeling.
Well, like, so you could say a line, like if the line was, I hate you. You don't necessarily have to say it like I hate you. You could be like, I hate you. You'd be happy. Or you could do it silly. I mean, it just taught you to just disconnect from the script and have an emotional life aside from it. And then you marry the two later. But it takes you years to come to that, I think.
Do you do the action verb thing or the action words for each sentence of the script? What you're trying to do?
No.
All right.
I don't do any of that crap. Okay. I don't know what I don't do.
Like you've been doing it a long time and you
that
do it.
Moment I do it, I don't, and I always feel bad when I see someone's script. I've got all these things written all over it, and I look at mine and there's like absolutely nothing.
So you don't even highlight the name?
Well, that I started doing just to look like I was like, you know, working out. Remember. You know, just
this is my line.
Highlighting it and then scribbling something to look like an X-ing and putting arrows and like exclamation point. And but I don't know. I just know I do it as I feel it, rehearse it, and then I know what it is. Or maybe I don't. Maybe sometimes I don't even know what I'm doing,
right.
But I'm doing it.
Yeah,
and it's working. So I don't have to. That's what I hate, having to talk about what I do after. Is like I have no idea,
right.
What everybody, I'm doing in this. I don't know how to break it apart or tell you. I just.
But you did a lot of it. And you do a lot of it, and you work a lot. So I mean, it's like eventually, it's your job.
Yeah, yeah, it's just my job.
Yeah, but the Neighborhood Playhouse, do they put on shows as well?
Well, for the second year students, you do to showcase to you know get agents to come.
And is that what you did?
I did. I didn't get an agent out of it though.
Really?
Yeah, I think I was too tall and too not pretty enough to be. An ingenue, too weird. Like I had to grow, I had to get older before I started working.
So what did you do from age 22 to 38 or whatever?
Oh God!
I mean, like you're telling me really that you didn't? You didn't?
Well, I did, honey. I did. Well, honey, yeah. Sweetheart.
It's okay,
baby.
Yeah, all
What's
of
your name again?
Mark.
Maron. Mark. Maron.
Yeah, I'm talking.
I
to
did.
You.
I did. I did. Okay, let me tell you. I scooped ice cream on Spring Street.
Uh-huh.
I worked as a nighttime receptionist at a recording studio, which I actually was a drug dealer there because I didn't know it, but I was
people were
would come in and
off.
Dropping things off for the nighttime session musicians. Like, oh, Mr. So and So, here, this came for you for you know. Da,
is
da,
there
da.
A Mr. So and So? Are you
yes,
hiding someone's
name? Yes, I'm hiding
name?
Someone's name. I'll tell you after because you'll probably know. I don't know, but
any
but,
of them.
But it was kind of crazy to realize that, and I didn't tell my parents that, of course. And then
did,
I
did
was.
Do they know about the Quaalude?
They don't.
Oh,
no.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're telling me. They're just down the street, wherever they are.
They're not going to listen to this.
No, probably not. My dad hasn't, so why would they?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And not one of the 900 and
come
some,
on. I mean, he's just lying to you.
Maybe he is. That's true. Maybe he
know.
Is.
I don't know. Is he that kind of guy? Would he be? Is he secretly proud of you?
He's like, no, he's proud of me, I think. Yeah, no, he's definitely proud of me. I don't know what he's doing. Like, you know, you talk about your dad playing guitar. My dad sits around going like, I just don't want to do anything. Like, he's got all this time on his hands, but he can't figure out one fucking thing to do. Except complain about not wanting to do anything.
What did he do for his life?
He was a surgeon.
He was a surgeon?
He was a surgeon.
God, couldn't he like knit what? Or something? Or
I don't know if that'll do it. He retired. He tried a lot of weird things. He became a postman for a while because he thought,
really?
I don't know, I think he had some weird idea that he would be socializing with people as a mailman. And then Then he worked at Walmart for a minute. But
How old is he? Is he like my
just 80s? Turned 80.
Oh, he's younger than my folks are five years older than. So he needs to be doing something.
Yeah, I don't know.
Get him a guitar. Does he play?
It's tough. You know, he sits around. He does like weird research online. He watches the wrong kind of television. You know,
What's the wrong kind of television?
Fox. He watches Fox.
Oh, the wrong kind of television.
Yeah. He doesn't know much about politics, but I think he likes the anger of it and the focus of the personalities, and he tends to think it's real news. And then he gets on the phone with me and starts talking, doing Fox talking points, and I'm like, I'm not even going to do this with you because you don't know what you're saying.
Oh,
and then I'll explain to him that there are three branches of government and that there's a legislative branch and a And then he's like, okay, maybe you're right. I don't really know what I'm talking about. But
your mom, what's your...
She's in Florida. She's all right.
Sure. So they're when your dad is...
Yeah, he's in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, where I grew up. Yeah. Everyone's better off that he's got his life there and his wife, and we're all very grateful that has him covered.
Okay. Copy that. But that worries me. I want to think about your dad just sitting there. It's like,
His hobby is complaining. You know, that's what he does. You know, that's his thing. Worrying and complaining.
I'm this close to that.
Really?
I don't want to go. I don't want to go to Mark Maron's pod.
Yeah, I know.
Where do I got to go?
What time? Can we do it earlier? Phil Rosenthal has a goose.
I was really excited about coming to talk to you, although intimidated because of all your, you know.
Anna Faris said you didn't want to do it.
Well, no, it's not entirely false. I didn't want to do it because I was intimidated and didn't, as I said, I didn't want to, I'm like a better listener and I feel like I don't have it. Well, whatever. I don't want to go down the self-pity thing.
I was intimidated.
Really? Come on.
What? I was. Yeah, Allison Janney's coming over, and I don't know. All I know is what I know from watching you work. I didn't know which character you would be when you came here, and most of them were scary. You're like, which one is she really? Because there's a few that I really don't think I could talk to.
Oh my God, you're right. Okay, I get that. But I hate when people think that they're going to be talking to CJ, and I'm not.
But somehow or another, you've managed to transcend that, which is impossible. I imagine there's plenty of people that still see you as her, but I didn't watch The West Wing. I'm one of those people. So, like, to me, you've always been that actress.
Yeah.
And then at some point, you were like, that's Allison Janney. She's amazing. But for about a decade, you were that lady.
That tall lady from the...
From American Beauty. And I remember seeing her in Little Things, right?
Yeah.
And then she...
Yeah, that's right. Martin Sheen calls me the big lady.
Oh, really?
He was terrible with names.
He knows
my name now, but he would call me the big lady.
How did you teach him your name? By walking up going, Allison.
I called him Pumpkinhead.
Oh.
Until he said my name.
I know it was a great show, but I don't know what years were that, because I was probably not watching television.
I think it was 2000 to 2006.
No, I don't know what I was doing, but TV wasn't part of it.
That's all right.
Yeah,
that's
I was so busy good. Trying to... to be a comedian.
A lot of people are coming to it now because it's so great.
Relevant.
It's an antidote to, you know, what's going on now.
Can we have that one? Why can't Martin Sheen be president?
Why can't he?
Oh, God. What a mess.
Oh, my God.
So you're scooping ice cream. You're a drug middleman.
Yep.
Middlewoman.
And I'm in a lot of theater companies. That was big theater companies. The Red Earth Ensemble.
Yeah.
The Fax.
In New York.
The Shadow Fax Company. And then Joanne started the group, the Actors Group of New York, otherwise known as Agony, which is funny. But we had that. So we just did plays and tried to get people to come see them, tried to get agents to come see them. And I had, you know, my terrible agent stories where people had said, you're not pretty, you're too tall, what are we going to do with you? Aliens and lesbians and all that kind of stuff I had.
And aliens and lesbians? Those are the options?
Yep.
Wow.
Apparently. And I just stuck it out. I just, I went to the Johnson O'Connor Institute to do aptitude tests to figure out what else I could do because nothing was happening.
And what came out? Figure skater?
No. Well, a systems analyst.
What does that even mean?
Well.
What do they do?
Well, is this is my my understanding is that there are someone hires them, and they go into a company and go, oh, I see, this is what's wrong. You need to do this, move this person over here.
Oh, right.
So they see what's wrong and fix
it. Right.
Fixers, I guess.
So you got the control freak diagnosis?
No, I feel like they didn't know what to do with me. They looked at, I envisioned these people
the
in a room that were like, what are we going to tell her? Well, I don't know, because I can't imagine. I can't do anything. Tell her she'll be, that's easy, systems analyst.
Yeah, yeah, it's vague.
And I don't know. And then I think the next day I got a job understudying Kate Nelligan and Faith Prince and Terrence McNally's Bad Habits at the Manhattan Theater Club. And that was a huge thing for me to get.
That was your first job?
That was my first job after I was going to quit for the last time. You know, I was really going to go
back.
In
these theater companies, did you come across people that you now know that are, you know, big actors? Or were you, because I know there were people that had theater companies. And
I don't think,
really?
I don't think a lot of people went on to do it.
Huh. It's tough. Long haul, tough racket.
If I were something else I could have done, I would have done it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Isn't it weird when you're possessed by something and then, you know, it's too late to do anything else? Yeah, what am I going to, you just like, you come up blank where you're like, I could always, oh no, it's too late.
I know, I'm at that age now where I just realize, oh yeah, I'm there's nothing else.
Even
at 38, it was like, wow.
That's scary.
Can't do that anymore.
So what was the big break outside of being Kate Nelligan's understudy?
Getting my first Broadway show was Present Laughter with Frank Langella.
Ooh.
That I did at the Walter Kerr Theater.
Oh, that's big.
And which is where Springsteen was doing his show, which was so cool for me to think. But anyway, that's where I had my Broadway debut, in that theater.
Frank Langella. He's a powerhouse.
Yeah, he is. I was terrified of him. Terrified, convinced I was going to get fired every day of rehearsal.
It was just the two of you?
No, it was a big cast.
Oh.
But I had to play his ex-wife, and we're the lead relationship in the play. And I was so terrified of him. And since, you know, I got through that awful phase, but it was really, and my younger brother Hal was the one who saved me with that, because he brought up that movie, the Gene Hackman, The Hoosiers, and they take the small town team to the big town, and it's like, look, it's the same size basketball court, measurements, relationship to that, and my brother was like, that's all it is. Just
because
it's Broadway doesn't, you know, it's the same relationship. You got an audience, you got a stage, and it did. It did kind of calm me down, help me get over the bad part of it. And once I was out there, you forget how much the audience, as much as I'm afraid of them, they really bring a lot to, you know, booing you up, like feeling like you got.
Oh yeah, it's like that's what you do it for.
Yeah,
like, you know, like I imagine after a week when you're actually doing the run, you're like, holy shit, this is the way I wanted to do this.
Yeah. It was kind of fun. I wish it had been fun going back to Broadway. I went to do 6 Degrees of Separation 2017, in the spring of 2017.
Yeah, no
I
good?
No, it was just, I had stage fright, like crazy.
Oh.
I was like, no. What? I haven't come all this way to have this bullshit. No, this is terrible. It was really, it was just, no, I hated it.
I'm laughing at something that, do you know Harbor? David, the actor from Stranger Things, it was just this, that moment where we were talking about when you're about to go on stage and you're freaked out.
Yeah.
And you've done it a million times, but like for some reason, there's that moment where you don't think you know any of it.
Yeah.
Like this, he just had this moment where he's like two lines away from his entrance and he goes, somebody give me a script.
I have lived that. I have lived that moment. I have many times.
Oh, it's horrifying.
It's terrifying.
Right
before, when I had to go on for Kate Nelligan in Bad Habits, I actually had to go on.
You did?
And the show starts with a big crack of thunder and lightning effect.
Yeah.
And I have to walk out on stage in that thunder lightning. And the thunder goes and I'm like, what's my first line? What's my first line? And I'm screaming, like literally didn't know. And I had to walk out. I'm like, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. And the lights came up and And it was there. It came out. It just came out. But I was...
That's the worst.
Oh, my God.
Because that's the one that you need to get in.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you can't get in.
Oh, my God. Why did we... It's terrifying. Awful. I felt like... I mean, not to bring up politics, because I don't want to talk about it. But that that meeting with Pelosi and Schumer and Pence and Trump in the... When Pence is sitting there, I was like, that is my actor's nightmare right there.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm in a play, but I forget what my lines are. I don't even know if I'm in the scene, but I'm out here on stage. Like, it was like, it just embodied everything that I fear about being on stage and not knowing.
Ugh, it's terrible. Now I'm worried about you making it to the Goose Party.
What time is it?
It's 4:30 already.
It's 4:30. That's fine. No, okay. I'm
we got
my Goose Party is, yeah, but I don't have to be there at 5.
Okay, all right. Because, like, I feel like, okay, so...
No, please.
I'm not freaking out. So you do theater, and then, like, you...
I got a soap opera, The Guiding Light. That was a huge thing for me to get in terms of paying my own rent.
Because
my parents have helped me along the way this whole time.
Sure,
I'm very fortunate to have had their help, even though my father would be, quite concerned and say, I think you might want to get a...
Yeah, maybe she'd be a systems analyst
something. Yeah, I think I didn't even tell them that outcome. But
because they would have went, that sounds fine, Allison.
But I was a ginger, this maid on The Guiding Light, and they paid me very well. It was
you did a lot of episodes?
Yeah, I did. I think I always forget. I think I did it for a year.
It's like a crash course in weird TV because they do, you just shoot like 100 of them, right?
Yeah, or I don't know.
My impression was they shoot quickly.
They did. They broke down the day in terms of you were either shot in the afternoon or the evening, or the morning or the afternoon.
They do like an episode in a day,
and
right?
It was great. It was very fast,
yeah.
And I loved it. It was kind of fun.
Did people know you from that?
No.
Oh, they
well,
didn't.
Some maybe some
ladies,
people out there, but no, I've never had anyone say, "Oh my God, Ginger on The Guiding Light." No one ever recognized me from that. But and then shortly after that, I did, Williamstown Theater Festival introduced me to a lot of people. That's where I think I made a lot of connections that paid off later. Stanley Tucci and I, we got cast in this play with Naked Angels called Fat Men in Skirts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Nikki Silver play. Really crazy, crazy play.
Yeah.
In it, it's a plane crash and we start off on an island. We've crashed our plane. Crashed on an island with my son. At the end of the first act, my son is sodomizing me. Then I'm like coming back crazy from the island. It's one of the, but it's hilarious. And
sounds funny.
It's really crazy and funny. But Stanley was in that with me and then he wrote this movie called Big Night. And
said,
hey,
I saw that movie.
Will you come, be in this movie?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a cool thing. And then Mike Nichols saw me in that production of Fat Man in Skirts.
Yeah.
And he put me in Primary Colors, which was a huge movie for me because I got to do that big pratfall down the stairs and be, and I know that's where Aaron Sorkin saw that movie and wanted to see me for CJ on the West Side.
So those were the primary ones.
Those are kind of big things that happened that introduced me to people who ended up.
So you didn't do a lot of bit parts in TV, or you did a few?
I did a few. I did one on Bill Cosby's show, and I don't remember which show it was of his.
You were still in New York, though? Or
I
when
was
did
in
you
New
come
York.
Out?
Yeah, oh, okay. I was in New York, and it was. I remember the going in for the part of a nurse, and then they changed it to a janitor, and then they kept changing my part around. And
yeah.
I don't even remember. I never saw it. I have no idea. So I did that little part. I did the soap opera. I did not too much, mostly theater, all theater things. And then.
So you were like, and did you actually do a Prairie Home Companion?
Oh, yeah, I did that a lot.
And was that like a regular gig? Did you have to live in Minnesota, or you'd go knock him out?
No, I had. I took that job because I was afraid of flying, and I thought I got to. I didn't want. I told myself I would never let my fear of flying get in the way of taking a job, and so I got auditioned for the Prairie Home Companion, and I got the part, and it meant that I would have to fly every Friday to Minnesota, and we would tape the show on Saturday, and I'd fly back Sunday.
Okay.
So I had to do that, but I had my younger brother lived in St. Paul, so I got to go see him, so I looked at it as an opportunity to see him and also just get over my fear of flying. So I did it and I had a great time working with Garrison. He's a very eccentric, odd, brilliant man. And I had a lot of fun with everyone who worked on that.
It sounded fun. I would listen to it sometimes because I just have NPR on when I was living in New York. And it was like, it seemed a little like oddly... I would just listen to it, but it didn't seem like it was really geared towards me, but I enjoyed it.
It's kind of hokey a little. But in a comforting
way. Guy Noir.
Yeah, Guy Noir. I love doing those skits with him, doing all those
voices.
Were
you the lady on Guy Noir?
In some of them, not all of them, but there was a season where I was, I played the lady in that, and I did the joke episodes with him, and he had some cool people working for him. There was this one guy, I wish I could remember his name, he had really long hair, and he would drive the trucks, and he would go to wherever Garrison was going ahead of time to hang out in the local bars and find out all the local stories and colors.
So the research,
Research, and then he'd give it to Garrison, who would write these unbelievable monologues. I mean, he would just go out and talk. He wouldn't have a script or anything.
Really?
He didn't have a teleprompter. He would just go out on stage and just talk for, it was kind of extraordinary what he could do.
Did he get into a little trouble?
I don't know.
Oh, I can't remember.
I feel like he, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now that you're saying that, I'm going.
I wonder, but you didn't have any problem.
No, not at all.
Nice guy.
He was lovely, and I enjoyed doing that show a lot.
So after those movies, though, like, I think the first time that like I really registered you was in The Ice Storm.
Oh, yeah.
I love the movie because it was my parents' generation, that they were coming of age as young parents in that time.
Did your parents do key parties?
I don't know, but they were... I feel like there might have been some swinging. I'm not sure, but like if looking at some of the pictures of them in the 60s, I was sort of like, why are they...
I don't know your parents, but I feel like looking at you, I would think that of your parents more than my parents.
Right. No, there's a lot of pictures of my mom and some swinging girls. Garments, my dad and some Nehru collars.
All right.
Yeah, maybe.
Parents. They were very...
That wasn't their bag.
No.
But that was like a big movie.
Yeah, it was cool. It was a really good movie to be part of. And I remember... And you know what else was... When did... Okay, American Beauty and Ice Storm. When did those
99.
Guys...
In 1999, American Beauty, Ice Storm 97. So you must have done it like a year after.
I guess so. I think maybe being in that Ice Storm was helpful to get in. Well, Alan Ball is the one who got me into... this is another theater connection because I did his play Five Women Wearing the Same Dress at Manhattan Class Company in New York. And Alan wrote that and he had me come in and read for Sam for American Beauty.
Uh-huh.
And then I got that. But
that part's so disturbing.
I know.
So what music were you playing for that role in your before you went on?
I remember. Actually, you know, it's weird. I remember sitting there in that dining room and just staring, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to think of the best sex you've ever had?
Yeah.
And I kind of thought about that.
But you didn't tell your face?
No. But it just like...
Longing.
Longing.
Mm.
Something... longing or something missing, just I don't know.
Oh my God, this is like it's a horrifying, it was sad character.
Yeah, very. I figured she was on the wrong dose of medication too.
Oh, that's what you're thinking.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it seemed like.
A little anesthetized.
And The Hours, that's a big movie for big actors.
That was good. That was the one movie Aaron let me go do that while I was doing West Wing. I was the only actor of the main group that wasn't in all of the episodes
because
he let me go do The Hours with Meryl and London. And that was pretty exciting to be part of that and be with her and have, you know, get to do a kissing scene with her and be like, you know, be her girlfriend. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And she was so much fun, which I loved about her. She was so not like this, you know, up on a pedestal and blah.
Sure.
She was just a girl.
Yeah,
she
likes
acting.
She
wanted to have fun. She liked to have fun and be, you know. And I remember, oh my God, where we were staying in some Hyde Park hotel. I don't remember, but it was a small little boutique hotel.
Yeah.
And I think it was John Cleese who was in the other, we were in the bar area and he was in the dining room. And I think she wanted to go say hi, but she didn't know if he would remember her. And I was like, Meryl, of course he would know who you are. Go say hello. And she comes back just absolutely dejected that she said she did her best sort of drive-by where she just sort of walked through, floated through, and like looked in his general direction and then didn't have the right eye contact and kept walking. And it was so...
John was probably just being a dick.
Probably. I don't know, but it made me love her even more that she was like, seriously, you think he's
Meryl
not going to... Just go say hello to him.
That funny.
Endeared
that guy
her to me.
I've talked to him. He's a good guy.
Yeah, I know. I listened to your podcast with him.
Yeah. So, but I guess that Juno too, like that really puts you on a bigger map. I know West Wing did, but as a film actress, starting to kind of like get away from the TV thing a little more, right?
Yeah, I was glad that I had the opportunity to have those, because I think as a lot of people knew my work beforehand as on stage and theater and other things, and Drop Dead Gorgeous was a movie that a lot of people are like huge fans of, cult fans of that movie.
Yeah.
And that was a crazy character I played. So anyone who was doing research, people just knew that the CJ wasn't the only thing I had in my pocket. Even
That's
though
a relief.
That was my introduction to the rest of the world. I mean, it became, a lot of people don't want to give her...
What's your relationship with Sorkin?
Sorkin, I love him. I wish I could work with him again. I don't know.
You will. No?
Familiarity breeds contempt sometimes.
Did you do that Studio 60 thing?
Or the did. I did. I got to be myself. One of the guest hosts.
And quality. So let's just get to winning an Oscar. That was exciting to watch.
Wow.
Could you believe it? Wait, how much did you think it was going to happen?
No, I love my friend Steven Rogers, who wrote I, Tonya, and he told me about it when he was writing the part back before he even finished the script. He said, I'm writing you a part and you get to wear a fur coat and have a bird on your shoulder. And I was like, okay, sounds like a winner, can't wait to, and then they were trying to figure out, they decided they were going to do it whenever we did it.
Yeah.
And I was doing Mom and I was rehearsing for my Broadway play I was doing.
The Six Degrees?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't have time to do this movie. And Steven's like, we're not doing it without you. So we're making it. I said, I honestly don't know if it's going to work. So the producers of Mom, the producers of Six Degrees of Separation, and the producers of I, Tonya all figured it out. But it was crazy. I was like, how am I going to...
It looks like you're always working, though.
Well, that was crazy. That was a real, that was a kind of unusual.
Yeah,
unusually
had to be
busy time.
Yeah.
And then to find out, I didn't think for, I mean, you don't, I think that's the best way to go into a role, not like I'm doing this role because I'm going to win an Oscar for it.
Right.
I don't know how many people can do that or who have done that, but I certainly didn't take it because of that. I took it because it was my friend Steven who wrote it and it was a great script. And
great tone.
It's really great tone.
Oh,
Craig Gillespie,
good.
God, he nailed that. And
which one was he?
He's the director.
Oh, okay.
He did a fantastic job. So I was I didn't know that was going to come of it, and then it started slowly building the word of mouth, and then getting nominated for things, and every time I'd win something, I thought, well, I'm not going to win the next thing. It just kept the pressure kept building, and because of who I'm up against. Laurie Metcalf's one of my favorite actors
Have
of
you
all
worked
time.
With her?
I've never, but I know her. I've
you
met her in passing. I just
together.
Love her so much. So I was I just and Octavia, who's my dear friend, I love, and I just, Mary J. Blige, there were so many, so when it was that night and I was waiting to hear my name, it was more of, when they said it, it was more like, oh my God, it was more of a relief that I didn't get to that point and lose because I'd won, it was just, there was so much pressure and so many people watching. I felt so many people's shoulders and eyes on me wanting me to win. And it was more like, oh my God, thank God. And then getting up there, I was just like, I felt somewhat just very calm and like, I was just, it's a lot to go through one of those campaigns. I've never done anything like that. So,
And
the
crazy.
Line that my friend Nick Bakay gave me to say, I did it all myself, was so fun to say because it was so, I mean,
such
I memorized the lines and I said them, but
he's a funny guy. How do you know him?
Nick and I were in college together. We went to Kenyon College together.
No kidding. Because he was involved with the first the first Comedy Channel like a million years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
That sounds right. Well, he's our show, one of our showrunners on Mom.
Right, that's it.
And with Gemma Baker and Nick is fantastic. I love him. We did plays together. We did.
That's cool. So there you go. That's a guy you've known forever.
Yeah.
And the movie was like, I thought the movie was great. And you dedicated the Oscar to your brother.
Yeah.
He had passed away?
Yeah. Well, he took his own life.
Oh.
Yeah. He was suffering probably a lot of mental issues, substance abuse.
For his whole life?
I would say pretty much, at least most of his adult, young adult life. I mean, he died when he was 49, so
oh my
I would
God.
Say most of his late, mid-30s on.
The struggle just got him.
Oh, yeah. He was in and out of places, and we kept trying to get him to, as my father said, he just couldn't find a place to land.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was really sad.
Is that something that's in your family?
There's a lot of
mental addiction. A lot of things.
Yeah, would say there's some pathology.
Yeah.
There, on both sides, I would say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think he just. I wish he had gotten the right help.
Yeah.
It
been going on for years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
I know. Me too.
Was that some of the impetus for doing a show like Mom?
Yeah. It was a world that I felt that I wanted to be part of, telling, you know, whatever I could do to destigmatize
it, normalize
it, and show people not just, you know, the dramatic parts of getting sober, but people who actually are living in recovery and having
and
fun,
hilarious
and hilarious and having fun. It just, that felt like an important story for me to tell, and I wanted to because of my brother. I feel like there are other ways I should be honoring him too, but
I think that's a good way.
A good way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, you know, I've been in the rooms for 19 years, and like, you know, there's a depth of humor and wisdom there that because of the language of recovery and because of the nature of people's personal stories in those rooms, like, you know, you're laughing at stuff that's pretty fucking dark.
Yeah.
And it's pretty beautiful.
I wish that he had found that that in the rooms. He just was like, I can't go to another fucking church basement.
Just resisted.
He did not like the community. He didn't like going to meetings. I don't know why the compulsion was too strong. I guess, is that what it is?
Well, I think, like, you know, everybody resists it at first, and it's just like either you're going to have that moment where, you know, you've really run out of ideas, right? Yeah. So, and then all of a sudden, you realize, like, well, I can make this my own. There's obviously help here, and, you know, and there's no rules necessarily, right? So, it's just a matter of, like, understanding the things for yourself and realizing, like, getting past the way the 12 steps look on a wall as being these weird God-oriented things and sort of integrating them, you know, understanding powerlessness, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the whole trick.
I don't think he got that. And the God thing always bothered him.
Yeah, but you can just remove that, I think.
I know. I feel like he had enough people telling him that, but he just didn't
want
to get it, I think.
Yeah, and there's nothing anyone can do after a certain point.
No.
You know, the powerless thing, it's like, I don't know, like, the disease is strong, you know?
Yeah. I've been in a lot of the Al-Anon meetings,
right,
and I love going to those, but I even get self-conscious thinking, do people think I'm here because of my show or what? You know, like, feel bad thinking people will think that. And then I went to one meeting where someone came up to me and said, just so you know, you're not safe here, so be careful what you say. And I was like, copy that. And then I should be in those rooms every day. I'm like the classic Al-Anon person every way.
Codependency is a rough game, you know, because it's so fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You know, to have to learn how to do that if you don't have the boundaries, or, you know, you're not like that. That sort of, like, the idea of detaching but caring is a tricky.
I know.
Oh, it's like
it's the most heartbreaking thing, too, because I think one of the last things we were just trying to get my brother to. We were in. Oh, I don't even want to. It's detached. It's this detachment part and cutting off from finances and things because
enabling.
Trying not to enable.
Yeah.
And just wanting to enable because I want to because that's loved to me.
Yeah.
What do you
need?
Safe. What do you
need? Yeah. How
do you
can
need
I?
Some Xanax? I'll go to Laredo. I'll go over the border and
right.
Get, I don't even know what else all was in his system in the end, and I wish I did know.
But was it was on purpose?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was very much on purpose.
Hmm. So, I think like it has working with, to sort of approach that as comedy must be kind of relieving in a way.
Yeah.
And Anna's really funny. And
she's
you're
hilarious.
And you get to do like three camera. But like it was interesting when I watched it because I watched a bunch of them when I talked to her.
Yeah.
Did not help the conversation. That was the. That's way up there with one of the like kind of more challenging conversations because like you know we were engaging and we were deeply engaged but she wasn't giving me much.
Yeah, she holds her cards close to her chest.
And I kept pushing. She kept charming me.
I know. She's like, no. We're not going to talk about that because then I have to talk about it. Yeah. She's hilarious.
But I liked it. I like having that tension, and it was fun. You know, I think the point where I'm talking to her while she's peeing was I think it was
that
the first.
Was my favorite thing.
Yeah, it was the first
it was
on the
hilarious.
Show.
It was hilarious. She is absolutely. She is so hysterical.
But I think that like even though it's a three camera, and even though it's very cleverly written, but it's still a joke driven show.
Yep.
That there's a depth to it because of the nature of what you're doing.
Yeah, and I'm grateful for that because I know there's a lot of we have to serve the jokes, but I love the moments that are quiet that we. That are real and
yeah, there's definitely
and,
some real shit in there.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I think you do great work,
Mark. I think you do too.
And I want you to go eat goose with Phil Rosenthal. Are you taking your parents? How's that work?
Yeah. Well, now I see. I was all worried about the logistics of everything because my mom's not good in the car with other people, and so my assistant is driving them, and then your guy.
Yeah.
Who you picked.
Who used to drive
Jose,
me occasionally. Yeah.
Jose was very nice. Yeah. A wonderful driver. He's going to drop me off at Phil's house right now.
Yeah, I think you can get there
Should
by 5:30.
Should I give the exact address?
Phil Would you, Rosenthal. Phil, and tell me where the house he bought his parents is. Yeah, I'd like to know where that is. Where's the house that Phil bought his parents?
I'm going to ask him that when I see you.
I don't know. I'm fine with Phil. I hope he's fine with me.
Well, he sounded like he was, but I'll find out more.
No, don't. Let's just leave it where it's at.
All right.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, too.
Wow, that was great. What a great time. What a great talk. What a great person. I like her. I love her. I love her. Is that all right? So again, Mom is on CBS on Thursday nights. It's in its sixth season. And Troop Zero, Allison's new movie, has its world premiere at Sundance this Friday. I'm going to play my three chords in a slightly different way than I usually play them again. Okay? So let's do that. My three chords happening now.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.